I want to recap a little bit about what's been going on, because in 2 Kings chapter 4 and 5 and the beginning of 6 here, we've been dealing with various miracles performed by Elisha. And I want to reiterate that those miracles are not in chronological order necessarily. There's no markers in the text that tell us definitively that these things happened one after the other or even when they happened, because that's not the point. The point that the historian is making for us is that God was signifying through Elisha his ministry and what he was trying to accomplish in calling the nation back to repentance. The same mission that God called Elijah to call Israel back to faithfulness to the covenant. That was also going on through Elisha, through miracles of various scales. So we read many miracles of Elisha that pertained to national events. We're going to read another one today. But we read the story of Naaman and healing his leprosy. That was kind of a nationalistic miracle because it affected both Syria and Israel. Many of the miracles were designed to show that God was indeed concerned about the individuals in Israel as well as the nation as a whole. So the widow's son being raised back to life, the widow's oil being multiplied, the curing of the poisonous stew that Elisha made well, the curing of the bitter waters at Jericho, all of those things showing that God is indeed also concerned about the daily lives of his people. We drew some great application there for the fact that God does care about what's going on in our lives. And so he did superintend Kathy's trip home, even though it had some difficulties, yet he was with her every step of the way. So today, as we get into chapter 6, there's one more miracle that is going to detail God's care for the individual, but then it's going to transfer to something much larger, or I shouldn't say larger, because that implies that there's something bigger about national things than there is about individual things, but something more of a national scale than a personal scale. So before we get to chapter 6, though, I wanted to show us the timeline we've been looking at to help us get an idea of where all these things are taking place. The kingdom of Israel has been divided for going on to 125 years. So Jeroboam and Rehoboam were the kings of the two nations, Jeroboam in the north, Rehoboam in Judah. And that occurred somewhere around, no, I don't want updates. I don't like updates. Don't update me. That occurred around 975 BC. So we have the dynasty of David in the southern kingdom, which went through Rehoboam and Abijah and Asa and then to Jehoshaphat. The things we're dealing with now are still in Jehoshaphat's reign. In the northern kingdom, we've been through several dynasties now. Jeroboam the first, and then Nadab, and Nadab was killed by Baasha, who instituted the second dynasty. Baasha, his son Elah took the throne for just a couple of years, but then Tibni killed Elah. And then there was a civil war for a few years between Omni and Tibni. And then Omri won in that civil war and took over sole rulership of the northern kingdom for several years. And then his son Ahab took over things and ruled for 22 years. Ahab's son Ahaziah only ruled for 2 years. And then in the beginning of the book of 2 Kings, we read that he fell off the upper story of his house, was wounded, and God told him he wasn't going to recover. When Ahaziah died, his brother Joram, or Jehoram, took the throne. Now, Elijah was translated to heaven very close in time to when Ahaziah perished. All right, so it's in the beginning of the reign of Joram that Elisha takes up the mantle and begins his ministry. You can see from the timeline that Jehoshaphat is still king in Judah. For a time, if you can see how Jehoram here, this is not the same Jehoram as up here, by the way. Remember, Jehoshaphat had a very close alliance with the northern kingdom. In fact, he took as a wife for his son, Jehoram, he took the daughter of Ahab. Okay, Athaliah is her name. Jehoram reigned alongside his father for several years. And that's what this little section here is. So for 5 years, he was king while his dad was also king. And we can read some of those markers are in the text, and we'll get to them. It's a couple of chapters from now in chapter 8. We'll cover that when we get there. But the wording is actually a little different. Usually it says, after so-and-so died, his son became king. But in Jehoram's instance, it says, while his father was still king, he became king. And so that lets us know there's an overlap there, which if we didn't know about that overlap, our ability to count years and come up with chronologies would be a little thrown off. But because God was faithful to preserve those details for us, we can come up. This is an amazing thing to me. Maybe it's because I'm a history nerd, but an amazing thing to me that we can piece together a history of the world from now all the way back to creation, because God recorded for us 4,000 plus years of history in His Word up till the end of the first century. And from then on, we've been able to keep fairly good records ourselves to know what's going on. Now, what I love about Scripture is that when God records history, He also records His synopses of that history, or He tells us His opinion of the things that are going on. When you're studying church history from the first century on, we can look at what actually happened, but we have to constantly be going back to the Word to say, should it have happened? Or was that a good decision, or was that a bad decision? You know, when you get into biblical history, oftentimes God steps in with the writing of the historian and tells us what God thinks about it. So when we get to the end of the northern kingdom and God kicks them out of the land, we're clearly told why that event happened. And that's a wonder to me. It just amazes me that we can piece together the history of our world all the way back to the beginning. And it's not millions of years, by the way. It's just a little over 6,000 years. Gives us some perspective on things, doesn't it? Well, we're covering this period of history here. Joram is king in northern Israel. Jehoram is king alongside of Jehoshaphat in the southern kingdom. Now, for a time, Jehoram will rule as the sole king, but then there's going to be some upsets that happen here when Jehoram is killed and Athaliah actually becomes a queen of Israel. All right? But we'll cover those things in a little bit, because for now the historian wants to draw our attention to another incident in the life of Elisha. Chapter 6, verse 1. Now the sons of the prophets, we've talked about the sons of the prophets. This was sort of like the ancient Bible college, where Elijah the prophet had established these schools to train people in preaching and teaching throughout Israel as a means to try to draw the population back to faithfulness to the covenant. And so these schools of the prophets were located in various places throughout the country. So now the sons of the prophets said to Elisha, "See, the place where we dwell under your charge is too small for us. Let us go to the Jordan and each get us there a log and make us a place for us to dwell there." And he answered, "Go." So here's the trouble that they're running into is whatever Bible college they're in, there were several, maybe it was Gilgal, maybe it was Bethel, maybe it was another place. The Bible college has seen a very good increase in enrollment over the past few years, and they're saying it's too small. There's not enough space for us all to live here, so here's our idea. Now, I don't know, Ed, if you were at Bible college, did they ever do any expansion projects at all? Not while you were there? Yeah. I was at Appalachian Bible College, and they did several during the years I was there. They built the Anderson Chapel. They expanded the office buildings. They were starting work on new dorms. But never once did they say, "All right, students, everybody grab an axe. We're going down to the river to chop down a tree." All right? This is a brilliant way to save money on a building expansion, by the way. If just grab all the able-bodied guys in the congregation and say, "Let's go down, we're going to grab a tree." I don't know where we'd go to grab trees from, but you know, maybe there's some nice hedgerows along here. If we can find some nice straight pine trees, maybe we can whop them down, drag them back here, and get enough timber to build a new expansion, right? But that's the plan. We're going to go down to the Jordan River. We're going to, everybody grab a log. And so everybody's going to grab the biggest tree you can carry. And we're going to build a new building out of it. That tells us a couple of things. What direction are they going? It's a very subtle little hint there. Where are they going to go? Yeah, they're going to go to the Jordan River. This is the Jordan River Valley that's darkly shaded there because it's descending in elevation very quickly. The Jordan River Valley is very deep, and it increases in elevation on each side very, very quickly. Now, we're not told exactly which school of the prophets they're talking about. There was one in Jericho, there was one in Bethel, and we read of one in Upper Gilgal, which was up here. There's also a Gilgal down here in the valley, but there was also an Upper Gilgal. We don't know which one it was. It's probable that it's the one in Jericho, because it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense if they were up here in Bethel or in Upper Gilgal while they would travel all the way down to the Jordan River to get trees. There were forests in Israel at the time. You know what's interesting? Anybody ever traveled over there? Do you know something you don't see a whole lot of? Trees. There are not many trees there, but you know what? At one point, the place was covered with dense forests. You remember, it's probably been a year and a half now, we studied David's life and his son Absalom. And how did Absalom come to his end? He got his hair stuck in a big oak tree. Remember, he was fleeing the battle on a donkey, and the thing ran right through the forest, and his big, thick, wavy locks, which he counted himself so handsome to have, turned out to be his undoing because they get stuck in the branches of the oak tree. And Daniel has this trouble sometimes when he's mowing out here and that oak tree branch dips down and tries to grab him, right? Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Aren't you glad we cut your hair more often now? Yes. I've never yet come out and found Daniel dangling by the oak tree with the mower just going off on its own through the farmer's field. So, yeah, don't try that, by the way. We'll come out one day, Daniel will have tried to carve his name over there in the corn, right? So, probably we're talking about the school of the prophets down at Jericho, but it is entirely possible that it's one of the others. So, their plan, let's go to the Jordan, each of us get there a log, and let us make a place for us to dwell there. So, they're thinking about moving operations to this new place and constructing a new building. Elisha's answer is go. He thinks this is a good idea. Then one of them said, "Be pleased to go with your servants." And he answered, "I will go." So this is a fantastic development for the school of the prophets because now Elisha is going to accompany them, which turns out to be quite a good thing for at least one young Bible college student. Verse 4, so he went with them, and when they came to the Jordan, they cut down trees. But as one was felling a log, his axe head fell into the water. How many of you are expert lumberjacks? Anybody do wood splitting, wood cutting, without a pneumatic wood cutter? Eldon, done a bit of that in your day? It's hard work, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, I've known lots of people that heated their house with wood. I love the smell of wood. But you know how hard of work it is. Even if you've never done it, I'm sure you know how hard work it is to chop wood. It takes a lot of effort. And especially if you don't have a chainsaw. I mean, with a chainsaw, it takes a long time. But imagine cutting up these logs with axes and with two-man saws. It takes a long time and a lot of energy. And so here this poor guy is, and he's chopping down his tree, and he takes a swing back, and the wedge has loosened out, and the axe head flies off the end of his axe and plunk into the water. Now, maybe you've heard some sermons about the Israelites crossing the Jordan River, because there's a pretty unique characteristic of the Jordan River in that it doesn't gently taper into a river. The Jordan River has steep banks. So once you're in the river, you're in the river. Which is such an amazing thing for those Levites when they were ready to cross the river, because God said, when you set your foot in the water, then I'll stop the water flow. And so you can imagine these Levites saying, if I set my foot in that water, I'm either going under carrying this big heavy ark, or we're going to be okay. and it's going to be dry. So it was a pretty good step of faith for those Levites to take that and put that first foot in the Jordan River. So here's this guy, and he's right on the edge of the river, and he's chopping down his tree, and the axe head slips off, falls into the river, kerplunk, and down it goes. So how do you retrieve an axe head out of a river? Now, we talked last week, too, about the Jordan River. Another particular trait of the Jordan River is that it is not a clean, clear, pristine river. It's muddy, it's murky, it's kind of dingy. And so there's no seeing the bottom. How are you going to go down and find this thing? Scuba dive. All right. We don't know if they had scuba equipment back then. Don't have any record of it, but maybe there were some good divers. But my guess is that this fella didn't take scuba 101 at the School of the Prophets. Tim? Magnetic fishing hook. That would be an interesting way to solve it. Mm-hmm. Or just call Elisha. Yep, well, Kathy's getting right to the point. Let's not mess around with all these other ideas. They do, and they call Elisha. And so here I've got this problem, but he's got another problem. Alas, my master, it was borrowed. Now, for most of us sitting here, we say, oh, okay, it's an axe head. They cost what, $25? I think you can get a cheap one for like $15. But all right, let's assume it's a decent axe head, and you're going to pay $40. It doesn't seem like that big a deal, does it? But remember when you're talking about, we're going back in history a ways, iron was not as easy to come by, nor was it easy to work back then. They knew how to work it, but it took a lot of skill. Go ahead, Eldon. It probably was something like that, yeah. Whatever it is, it's expensive, and so here's this poor Bible college student, or this son of the prophet, and he obviously doesn't have the means to pay for it. So what happens in Israel if you have a debt you can't pay? You become servant to the person until it's paid off, right? He would pay you a wage, and that wage would get credited towards the thing until it was paid off. Now, that is under God's law. Where are they living? Southern Israel, where they keep God's law, or northern Israel, where they really don't care? They're in northern Israel. Northern Israel, at this point in history, does not do God's law. So what happens to somebody that can't pay a debt? It's not temporary servitude. You're sold as a slave permanently. So you can understand why this Bible college student is a little distraught. I had many times as a student where I had to go in and talk to the business manager, and he would say, you know, Brian, your bill here is getting a little out of hand. You owe us for some classes you've taken. Okay, I'll see what I can do, right? You don't want to be in that position. And neither does this guy. So he cries out to Elisha. He does what Kathy recommends. So here's a guy we know will know what to do about this. And so, alas, my master, it was borrowed. In verse 6, then the man of God said, where did it fall? And when he showed him the place, he cut off a stick, threw it in there, and made the iron float. And he said, take it up. And he reached out his hand and took it. So we understand principles of physics. If you drop a big heavy iron piece in a river, how far downstream is it going to float before it hits the bottom? Not very far. That thing's pretty much going straight down. Buoyancy, right? Iron is a whole lot more dense than water. And so it just blunk, 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 blunk. It might move a little bit. I have lost things in a lake before. It's almost impossible. Even if it's only a few feet deep, it's really hard to find it. So if you're talking about something that's 6 or 7 feet deep and you can't see very well, almost impossible to dive down there and find it. And then on top of that, if you can't put your feet down and stand up, how do you carry an iron axe head to the surface? You call the other son of the prophet in, you stand on his shoulders, and hopefully you get it out on the shore before he can't breathe, right? If you can find one willing to help you. Well, their solution is a miracle. So Elisha comes over, asks where it has been thrown. The guy shows him the spot, and he throws a stick in the water. And would you believe there are some commentarians that say, well, he managed to just fish it out with his stick. He put the stick down through the hole in the axe head, and he was able to lift it out that way. Can you try lifting? I mean, how much does an axe head weigh? They're 7-8 pounds. They're pretty heavy. They might be more than that. But to find a stick that would support that weight, it's probably not going to happen. And the odds of reaching down in there and grabbing that thing in that murky water would be almost miraculous enough. But that's not what the text describes as happening. He throws the stick in, meaning he's no longer holding on to the stick, right? Now, this is not the first time Elisha has used a stick as a medium of God's power. Whatever that's all about, there he threw a stick into the bitter waters in Jericho. Now he's using this stick as a symbol of God's working. Moses used the staff to part the Red Sea. So we know it's not the staff, right? Maybe this stick was given to Elisha by aliens and had special magnetic properties that the people then didn't know about. And so that's how he got it out. You know, it's like one of those extension things you use to pick up bolts that you drop. No, it's a stick. He throws it in the water and the axe head floats. It doesn't come up on a magnet. It doesn't come up on a line. God, in his power, is able to change the buoyancy of that axe head and it just pops to the surface of the water. Any other instances of God making things float on water that really have no business floating on water? Jesus walks on the water. Now, the human body floats, especially if you're composed of a little more fat ratios than, you know, you really should be. I float pretty well. But the human body floats, but it doesn't stand on top of the water. Neither do axe heads. It's not a property of iron. And so here's God overturning the laws of nature, because the laws of nature are simply our way of describing how God normally acts. Right? What we call law of nature is simply God's consistency. Normally speaking, does iron float or sink? It sinks. Why does it sink? Well, because the atoms in the matter is denser in an iron than it is in water. Well, yeah. But because that's the way God designed the world. And God designed it very consistently. We asked Gary this question several weeks ago, because aren't you glad that God is very consistent in how he orders the physical world? Because how hard would it be to build a lawnmower that the tensile strength of iron changed from day to day? Right? And you're never quite sure, is that bead of weld going to be enough on this one? Because, you know, this iron might not be the same as that iron over there. We depend on those things. We depend on consistency in God's creation. That's why we can get light bulbs to work. It's why we can get computers to work. Because when you apply a charge to that little filament, it lights up. We know that because God is consistent. Once in a while, not very often, but once in a while, God intervenes and changes things. And here he's doing it for the sake of this young man to keep him from being sold into slavery. So does God care about the goings-on of individual lives? Absolutely. God cares about you. So that's why he can tell us, don't be anxious for anything, but in everything, through prayer and supplication, let your requests be made known unto God. Well, that account of the axe head then transitions in the next verse into another miracle of Elisha that has a more of a national impact. We titled tonight's message, Floating Axe Heads and Spiritual Espionage. This is where we get into like Jason Bourne kind of stuff, you know, spy movies. Anybody like a good spy movie? Yeah. You like the suspense, the thrill. Is the guy going to get caught? You know? Is he going to be able to escape the bad guys? And that's what this account is about, except it's real life stuff, okay? So once, that's the only time marker we get. Once. Like once upon a time in a fairy tale. So what does it tell you about when this happened? Yeah, not much, right? At one time. So we have to look for some other things. The king of Syria was warring against Israel. That gives us another kind of time frame. But it's kind of broad because Israel and Syria were almost constantly at war. They had a very tenuous relationship. During the reign of Ahab, Syria conquered most of this northern region of Israel and all of this over here in the region of Ramoth-Gilead. That's why at the end of Ahab's life, he said to Jehoshaphat, let's go attack Ramoth-Gilead to get it back. And that was the battle in which Ahab died. So Israel and Syria have been on-off fighting for a very long time. Now, we do know one thing about the timing of this, and that is that it is going to involve Elisha, not Elijah. which clearly puts us back on our timeline after Joram, or after Ahaziah, somewhere after this. So we're probably talking about Joram's reign, not Ahaziah or Ahab. The historian gave us pretty good information and relation of the events of Ahab's life and how Elijah impacted those things. So, we're talking about a war between Syria and the king of Israel, probably talking about Joram, Ahab's son. So, at one time, when the king of Syria was warring against Israel, now I want you to plug this into what we learned last week. Who did we talk about last week? Pop quiz. Naaman. Where's Naaman from? Syria. Okay, so Naaman the Syrian came down to Israel with letters to the king asking how he could be healed of his leprosy. And that tells us a little bit about the fact that at that point, Israel and Syria were sort of on better relations. But how quickly do the relationships between nations change? Pretty quick. Are we at peace with North Korea? Who knows? You know, 3 weeks ago it was different than it is today, right? Things change quickly. So at this period of history, Syria and Israel, they are back and forth all the time. So we're probably talking sometime during here, but who knows? We don't know whether this is before or after Naaman comes down. There's just not enough information in the text to give us any idea there. So what's going on? The king of Syria is warring against Israel, and he took counsel with his servants. I do find this interesting, that if this is anywhere near the same time as the healing of Naaman, then who's the one of these servants? Naaman. Naaman the Syrian was chief of the king of Syria's chariots. And so if there's a war council going on, and if we're anywhere near the same time, there's a good chance this is Naaman. But again, it doesn't tell us that. He took counsel with his servant, saying, "At such and such a place shall be my camp." What's he talking about here? What kind of camp? They're going fishing, hunting, you know, woodsman skills. Home base for war. All right, we are invading Israel again, and here's where I'm going to set up my camp. Verse 9, "But the man of God," and that would be Elisha, "the man of God sent word to the king of Israel, 'Beware that you do not pass this place, for the Syrians are going down there.' And the king of Israel sent to the place about which the man of God told him. Thus he used to warn him, so that he saved himself there more than once or twice." So here's a scenario that's going on repeatedly over a larger course of time. The king of Syria would come down and try to do a raid on Israel, but Elisha would warn the king of Israel and say, "Don't send any troops, don't send any provisions that way. Keep everybody out of that area so that the Syrians have nobody to prey upon." And it says, not once, not twice, many times, that saved people. Well, if you were making military plans and they constantly got thwarted by nobody showing up to fight you, what would you start to think? There's a spy! Somebody in my council is leaving here and taking the plans to the king of Israel. Okay, even today, what is the penalty for treason? What's that? I don't know if we do the firing squad today, but it is execution. Death penalty still holds for treason. They don't carry it out quite as much as they used to, but it still is the law. Well, back then, there would have been much less of a trial. As soon as they had an inkling that you were a traitor, you probably were done for. And so you can imagine everybody on the king of Syria's counseling staff is probably a little uptight right about now, saying, "Oh boy, I hope he doesn't try to pin this on me." My imagination sort of ran here and said, wow, what if Naaman were one of these people? Naaman just came back healed from Israel and has converted to worshiping Jehovah. How would that look to the king of Syria when all this starts happening? And again, the text doesn't tell us, so I'm just using my imagination there, and you're free to use your imagination another way. Verse 11, the mind of the king of Syria was greatly troubled because of this thing. We can understand that. And he called his servants and said to them, will you not show me who of us is for the king of Israel? Which one of you is a traitor? Now, I don't know, how many of you like Westerns? You like old Westerns? I love the old Westerns, right? But it always cracks me up in those Westerns when the police officer runs out and he almost always shouts the same thing, stop in the name of the law. Did the bad guy ever stop? Did the bad guy ever say, ah, you caught me, rats? No, they never do, right? That command is not going to do anything. Do you think, is the king of Syria here, he's shouting at all of his servants. Do you think the guy that's doing it is going to say, ah, nuts, you caught me? Well, of course not. He's going to continue to try to cover things up, right? But this is the frustrated point to which the king of Syria has come. He doesn't know who keeps thwarting his plans. He couldn't. And so now he's taking out his anger at his staff. So which of you is for the king of Israel? Now, I can imagine, too, the servant that says this. Would you want to be the guy that says this? Or I can imagine him just like slowly raising his hand and saying, sir, can I say something? A little timid-like. And he says, one of his servants said, none, my lord, O king, but Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom. Which other character in the Bible found out there's nowhere you can hide from God? Well, David wasn't hiding from him, right? Jonah. Yeah, but both of them did find out a similar thing. Where is God? Everywhere. He's everywhere. And it's not that part of him is over there and part of him is over there. He is all right there and he's all right there. He is everywhere all at once. It's one of the things about him we'll never quite understand. So, can you really make any secret plans? Well, maybe if you only think it. If you only think it, then can you keep it secret from him? No, because he knows the thoughts and intents of our heart. Eldon. Now God's got night vision. That's right. Hebrews chapter 4, the word of God is quick, powerful, sharper than any two-edged sword, capable to the dividing asunder of the soul and spirit, the joints and the marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart. Not only does the word of God shine a light on us so that we can understand our own thinking and understand how to make righteous decisions as opposed to unrighteous decisions, but it also tells us that God knows exactly what we're thinking all the time. So, he says, nope, it's the prophet Elisha. He knows what you're thinking. Now, do you think the king of Syria is going to attribute this to the power of God? No. What's he going to attribute it to? Probably the sorcery of a prophet, right? In every nation around Israel, the priests were pretty much sorcerers and wizards. They communed with spirits. They performed spells and incantations by which they were able to accomplish amazing things. They were able to do signs and wonders. And so, one of the practices they also had was called divination, where they would cut up an animal and they would examine the shape of its liver. Fun stuff, right? And they would, they had entire encyclopedias written for how to interpret the shape of a sheep's liver. And we find these things buried in the sand out there. And so the Canaanite religion, tons and tons of things, literally entire encyclopedic sets of how to interpret omens, like sheep's livers or reading tea leaves or tarot cards. You understand, these things are not modern inventions, right? What happens if a black cat crosses your path? What does that mean? Bad luck. Okay, this is a Norse version of it. Luck is from the Norse god Loki. All right, so if a black cat crosses your path, that's an indication that Loki has got a bad determination for you. You have bad luck. Well, they had all kinds of omens like this. Some of our modern stuff, we call them superstitions, but they're not superstitions. They are interpreting omens, like black cat crossing your path, breaking a mirror, any one of those things. And so if you had a bad omen, you had to perform the appropriate sacrifices to appease that god. Well, the king of Syria is probably assuming that the prophet Elisha is doing things like divination and that some spirit is telling Elisha these plans. And so what's the answer? Let's go kill the prophet. But what does he not understand? Who's actually telling the prophet these things? God is. How do you stop that? You don't. Because there's a great promise to us, if God be for us, who can be against us? But let's take the inverse of that. If God be against you, who can be for you? No one. Eldon, you were going to comment. Yeah, I'm not sure what the omen would be for running over the black cat. So, what's that? Yes, yeah. All right, any questions? We'll go ahead and pause there because I know I can see all your